From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. On today's show, the rise of the nerd, those brainy, socially awkward people who are hopelessly out of fashion. And why today, nerds rule. The geeks have inherited the earth. We'll find out who nerds are and why labeling someone as a nerd is not a cool thing to do. We'll also find out if there are girl nerds and listen to nerdcore, hip-hop music made by and for nerds.
Those crazy noises are computer signals.
Yeah, some guys at MIT are sending us reasons why Captain Picard is better than Captain Kirk.
They're out of their minds.
Nerds are nothing to fear. In fact, they've done some pretty memorable things. Some nerds of note include popcorn magnate Orville Redenbacher, rock star David Byrne, and Supreme Court Justice David Souter.
Oh, not Souter! Oh, no!
Benjamin Nugent is the author of American Nerd, The Story of My People. The book explores the history of nerdiness and the different subcultures that we tend to think of as being nerdy. According to Nugent, there are two main categories of nerds.
The first type of nerd, disproportionately male, I think. These people are intellectual in ways that strike people as machine-like and socially awkward in ways that strike people as machine-like. They tend to remind people, sometimes pleasantly, of machines. The way they do this is they're passionate about some technically sophisticated activity that doesn't revolve around emotional confrontation or physical confrontation. For example, sex, food, beauty, these are things that revolve around one of those things. However, if what you're into is computers or Dungeons and Dragons or chess, this isn't the case. They speak in language unusually similar to written standard English. They seek to avoid physical and emotional confrontation, and they favor logic and rational communication over nonverbal, non-rational forms of communication. And they tend to enjoy working with machines more than most people do. So that's the first type of nerd. And then the second type of nerd is somebody who, for arbitrary reasons, they wear the wrong outfit on the first day of third grade or what have you, is put into a nerd category by their peers and defined as a nerd because of their lack of social acceptance. But that categorization doesn't reflect anything intrinsic about their mental state.
Do you feel as though you fall into one of these categories, or do you even consider yourself a nerd? Is that just something that people called you?
You know, I was a really nerdy kid, and I think I fell into the first category when I was a kid. I was obsessed with rule-bound activities like Dungeons and Dragons and video games and computer programming. And then when I was a teenager, I changed. And so I think that's one of the reasons I have always, and this book does, resist any neurological explanation for nerdiness. I think it's always a matter of temporary circumstances, or often a matter of temporary circumstances. And when I went out and examined nerds for this book, I spent a lot of time hanging out with nerd subcultures. I was always looking for how the circumstances of people's family lives, other factors, made them nerds or made them non-nerds.
You did a fair amount of research for this. You went looking for nerds, and I suppose the logical place to go is high school. Where'd you look? The debate club? The ham radio enthusiasts?
Yeah, both those places. I spent a lot of time with high school debate kids, and I really loved that part of it, actually. It was really moving for me seeing how they got together when one of them died in a car accident, and the way that this apparently emotionless activity that they all participated in really was fraught with emotion and all brought them together in a very emotional way. I also really liked spending time with people who reenacted medieval battles. If you've never seen about 500 to 1,000 guys on each side dressed in armor charging each other on the floor of the Arizona desert with swords made of rattan, then you haven't lived. You haven't experienced nerdiness. in its purest form.
Is that what ties these, I guess you'd call them subcultures, is that what ties them together, the interest in trying to find an intellectual or rational or logical means to look at life?
I think for a lot of them, yes, especially for kids who are in high school. The world they're in seems like such an arbitrarily created hierarchy with no reasonable order. And they can create alternate worlds for themselves that do have a reasonable order and where anyone can join as long as they have the intellectual prowess and the know-how. It's a fairer, more meritocratic world, usually, that they create. And when I was a teenager, I certainly looked for that in subcultures like the kids who played Dungeons & Dragons at my school, if you can call that a subculture. And when I went back and followed around my nerdy friends from high school, I absolutely found that that was the function that those activities fulfilled in their lives. It was a way of creating a more rational, fair, alternate universe.
So when you went back and looked at these same cultures from an adult perspective, what surprised you the most?
I think what surprised me the most was the fact that for so many of the kids I knew in high school, the activity at hand was a way of escaping from an extremely confusing home life in which they had no control. Because I think on some level, I'd always bought the stereotype of nerds that they tend to come from. Well, I don't know if this is something that's made explicit in movies and TV, but we tend to show nerds as coming from middle-class homes and being sheltered kids who aren't tough. And I was really surprised to learn how secretly tough my friends in high school were, that they came from really difficult home lives. You could argue they were abusive or semi-abusive home lives, and that this was their way of maintaining control and having that sense of being able to be competent over something in their lives, that they could go off into this rational world. And I think I'm struck by what a mature, productive way of dealing with the hand they were dealt that was. And I didn't realize that that was what was happening at all when I was a kid. When I was a kid, I think I felt guilty about it, and I left it as soon as I could.
Did you, in talking to the kids who are now nerds, if you will, find that they had any better understanding of it than you did at that time?
That's an interesting question. I don't know if they had a better understanding that that's the function it filled in their lives. I don't think they did. I think it's only in retrospect that we were able to talk about it and figure out that that what was going on. I mean, a couple of them said explicitly, you know, when I went over to your house and your mom was around, things were more rational. And that was a huge relief for me, that we were doing some rational activity and the adults were reasonable and it was safe. And that was a stark contrast with their own home lives. And so they were aware of that at the time. But I don't think at the time they were aware that the nerdy activities we were pursuing, like D&D and computer games, had a function almost similar to religion or worship for other people, a way of going off and entering a sanctum.
You also write about what you call nerd ethnicity. Can you explain what that is?
Sure. If you look at our stereotypes of nerds, you'll find that they share common ancestors with ethnic stereotypes. There was a word that was very popular in the progressive era, late 19th century, early 20th century, called greasy grind. And the greasy grind was a person who got into a good college, usually, by working extremely hard and quote-unquote grade grubbing in high school. And greasy grinds freaked people out because you could be an immigrant, you could be Jewish, or this was later. At the time, no one really thought of the Chinese this way, but they were starting to. You could be Jewish and get your way into a WASP enclave. Most of the elite colleges in this country at that time were largely still WASP enclaves. And it was considered a threat to the Protestant establishment, or even worse, they explicitly said at that time, the Nordic race, quote unquote. You know, the sort of Great Gatsby stuff about Nordics was really something people talked about. Teddy Roosevelt referred to phys ed being mandatory as a racial defense weapon for Nordics, that we had to, you know, that we had to create these strong Nordic men. So these Jewish immigrants who studied really hard and who could get into the Ivy League were discriminated against in admissions policies and socially discriminated against, certainly. And I think the greasy grind and the way that person was portrayed has a lot in common with the way nerds were portrayed late in the 20th century. Of course, the nerd is the greasy grind drained of ethnic associations. I don't think when people say nerd now, they think Jew, but it's the descendant of an ethnic stereotype.
And this sort of leads into the theory of contemporary Western racism and its relationship to the jock and the nerd, isn't it?
That's right. I draw a chart that I call the racism chart. And the case I'm making is that if you look at the way African Americans are stereotyped and the way Asian Americans are stereotyped and the way we've tended to think of the animal and the machine and sensuality, then what happens is in a lot of racist art and literature and propaganda, white people see themselves as the middle ground between one side, which has Asians and machines on it, these unsensual industrial things that are really good at thinking and are very industrious but aren't sensual at all. And then on the other side are African Americans and animals, and they are characterized as primitive, too close to the land, and the Native American is also on this side, and the white man gets to be right in the middle. And I think that that's one way of talking about how the ethnic stereotypes on the primitive side sort of turned into our stereotype of the jock and our notion of the jock, and those stereotypes on the machine side turned into our idea of the nerd. It's hard to describe this chart verbally, but I put the nerd somewhere close to the Asian American machine side on the racism chart and the jock on the other side.
It's funny, isn't it, though, because as I understand your definition of nerds, they tend to be mostly white guys.
We don't really know that, but one study by a social linguist is the term, from UC Santa Barbara, Mary Buchholz, in one school in California, and this is just one Californian school, found that most of the kids who considered themselves nerds were white, and that unlike the really popular white kids, who she called the hegemonic white kids, they did not appropriate any African-American slang. That if you were one of the popular kids at this high school, one of the ways you acted out popularity, you showed yourself to be a popular kid, was to occasionally use African-American slang and incorporate it into your speech, whereas the nerdy kids never did that. She talked about the implications of this and what African-American slang seemed to symbolize for these kids. And using Greco-Latinate words instead of Germanic words was another badge of nerdiness. And the refusal to incorporate African-American slang was part of the linguistic arsenal, if you will, by which nerds showed who they were to each other. You could recognize another nerd by the fact that they cleaved to something like written standard English.
Benjamin Nugent is the author of American Nerd, The Story of My People. In August 2005, a friend dragged Dan Lamoureux to see a nerd rapper named MC Chris perform in Chicago. Before the night was over, Lamoureux realized he wanted to find out more about this world of geek rap. So he made a documentary called Nerdcore for Life. Dan Lamoureux is a self-described dork. He told Anne Strandchamps that's what inspired him to make a film about the nerdcore culture.
If there's a social ladder for geekiness, nerds are above dorks. And so as a dork, I look up to nerds because, you know, they have skills. So when I realized that there were people making nerdy music, I thought, well, this is so bizarre. And like, you know, even now, I've known about it for almost 3 years. And even trying to describe it, it's like, that's just weird. How can that be? And so it's a perfect fit for a documentary because it raises a million questions.
Yeah, I have to say this was completely off my radar. I mean, geekster rap, who knew?
Mm-hmm.
So what is geekster rap or nerdcore? What does it sound like?
Nerdcore is simply hip-hop made for nerds by nerds. And the intended target is hardcore geeks. So if you're listening to some computer science nerdcore, you're going to hear some pretty obscure rhymes about coding and hardware and software and things that are going to go over most people's heads.
Yo, MC++, my rhymes are so fat. I'm piece-based complete, but I'll reduce you to 3 sat. My crew is so hard that we roll an NP, and bitches dereference my porn for free.
To really enjoy some of the best nerdcore, you have to be a die-hard, devoted geek to whatever subject matter is being covered. There's an anime rapper named Ultra Cloistron, who's one of my favorites, and I don't understand 99.9% of what he's talking about. To really get it, you have to basically live and eat, drink, and sleep anime to get his music. And I don't, but it's still fun.
Yo, understand that I do know who I am, even if I rhyme about lame publicans, man.
So it sounds like there are sort of sub-genres of nerdcore. There's computer programmer rap, and then there's anime rap. What else?
That's one of the most interesting things about nerdcore is that there are a million types of nerds, and so there's a million different little subgenres of nerdcore. And so you'll have the computer science guys. That's one of the most popular areas. You'll have a lot of video game hip-hop. People will take kind of old Nintendo games and then remix the music, the little blippy 8-bit music, and make beats out of it, and then rap about The Legend of Zelda over it.
I level up my druid when I'm playing World of Warcraft, stomping anybody stepping close to my warpath. It got serious, I'm passing up booty so I can finish the quest, because that is my duty.
And you have, you know, people who, there's one group I can think of that is totally devoted to the Lords of the Rings.
He's Spiegel, not Deagle. Step up to the mic, he look regal. He's mean, he's green. Gonna be fox like you never seen.
My precious.
And then there's guys who rap a lot about Star Wars, and then there are guys who rap about their favorite comic book characters.
I'm hardcore when it comes to anime. Some call it Japanime, kendo I keep it anime. I'm on that witch hunter arc. Cowboy bebop, Hagane no Renkin jutsu, she no detox.
Think you can cook? I got a grappling hook. Let's make this quick, cause I'm really booked. I'm a devious degenerate defender of the devil. Shut down all the trash compactors on the detention level. My backpack.
It does kind of get mixed around. I think they get a little bored of their kind of one niche after a while, so they kind of spread out into other areas. And, you know, basically geek culture and internet culture is what brings them all together. They all kind of can rap about that because that's the one thing they all share in common.
So as you set out to explore this kind of subculture, did you trace it back to an origin as a starting point? How long has nerdcore been around?
Hip-hop in the earliest days in the 70s and 80s, it was about having fun and, you know, being yourself and not caring what people thought and just having a good time was the whole point. And so hip-hop has changed a lot in you know, the last few decades. But in a weird way, nerdcore is a bit of a throwback to the original days where people just didn't care what, you know, everybody thought. They just did what they wanted to do and have fun and talk about their lives. And so in the late 90s, a lot of people started getting online and they started getting home computer software. And so as internet connections were getting faster and computers were getting better, people were able to make songs at home and then upload them to the internet for other people to hear. And so a lot of acts all at the same time around, you know, the world simultaneously started making hip-hop about things that they love, nerdy stuff, and posting it to, you know, to their home pages.
I'm the hunt for this mammal that once took my leg, with my worn down crew and my man Queequeg.
You're never gonna find him.
He's a big sperm whale.
The ocean is enormous.
Shut up, we're setting sail.
And so there are guys like Whitey Cracker, MC Frontalot, MC Hawking. They're kind of the pioneers of nerdcore.
MC Hawking, that's got to be a reference to the physicist Stephen Hawking.
Yeah, he's a kind of a character created by a web designer named Ken from Boston. And he uses a computer-generated voice program, just like the one Stephen Hawking has, to make hip-hop.
I'm a disciple of science. I know the universe is in full compliance with natural laws, but many place reliance on the pseudoscience of quacks and morons and fools because their education's deficient. They put faith in omniscient, make believe beings who control their fate, but the hawk ain't with it. Take it, their holy writ ain't the least bit legit. It's a bunch of bull.
You know, it strikes me that part of the appeal of hip-hop, traditionally at least, was it was about giving a voice to the underdog, you know, to the underclass. Is that part of why nerds who and geeks who've been traditionally, you know, in high schools at least, in mainstream culture, the underdogs, is that part of the appeal?
I definitely think so. I mean, rock has always had a geeky side to it. Nerds have taken a lot of crap, basically, for a long time, and they've always been kind of the one little group of society that it was always okay to make fun of and everything, and they're kind of fed up. And they're realizing, you know what? It's the 21st century, and the world, we own it now. This is ours, and we don't have to take any more crap. We're in charge. Hmm.
So tell me about some of your favorite nerdcore artists. Who do you like best?
There's a guy named Whitey Cracker. He calls himself the undisputed king of nerdcore, and he kind of is. He used to be a computer hacker, and he was busted for doing some kind of serious stuff to, like, the NASA websites and everything. And he got in a lot of trouble, but he reformed. Now he's like some very, very well-off web entrepreneur and also rapper on the side.
So does he have more, I guess, the nerdcore version of street cred because of that kind of background of his as a hacker?
they call it nerd cred. They call it nerd cred. Yeah, so his nerd cred is
sky
undeniable.
High.
And yeah, exactly. He's got the FBI records to prove it.
Cybercrime seems to be how some people, particularly juveniles, feel important. For Whitey Cracker, a 17-year-old drop.
Big smile and programming the hand in these fans with unbeatable jams, and let's face it, I'm visually basic. Hand me a website now to face it.
Where is this movement going? I mean, I guess so far I was thinking this is a lot of nerdy white guys who are making music in their basements and playing it for each other, but it sounds like it's actually starting to go mainstream.
It's creeping into the mainstream. It's so bizarre because when I started the film project, I mean, nobody knew what nerdcore was. And basically, the film was just going to be me visiting geeks in their basement of their mom's house, you know, while they make some music. Now they do shows and people show up, like a lot of people. People are into it, which baffles me. But there are a lot of nerds out there. Most of them are in their early 20s, and they grew up with hip-hop as being the dominant social force. I mean, they grew up with it everywhere, all around them. And so you can't expect them not to want to be a part of it, at least a portion of nerds. It's part of the American culture now, and a lot of nerds are growing up with it, so they want to participate. One point about nerdcore I always try and get across is that it's not just a bunch of white dorks making hip-hop and making fun of it or anything. It's a very kind of multi-ethnic movement. They're all, you know, nerds of every shape, color, kind, and creed these days. And so consequently, same thing with nerdcore.
A lot of the musicians you interviewed seem to be promoting a kind of nerd pride. Is nerdcore as a scene kind of about reclaiming nerdiness?
I definitely think so. They're tired of hiding in their basement. And if they love Dungeons and Dragons, they want to shout it from the rooftops. And they're tired of pretending to be things that they're not. And that, they even discuss that in the film that, you know, when they were younger, they felt ashamed that they loved certain kind of nerdy things. Now that they're grown up and they realize that they were wasting their youth by hiding what they love from people, they should have been out there and finding other people to do those things with.
Hmm. You know, there are a lot of paradoxes in this movement. One of them is, how do you create a social movement out of people who are famously introverted?
What first interested me about nerdcore was that I went to a nerdcore show, and I was shocked that there were nerds in the audience, because we were at kind of a cool club here in Chicago, and you don't really see those type of guys hanging around in that club. And I was like, I can't believe that these people made it out to do a social activity and be with other people and see live music. That's crazy. That's not nerdy. You know, it's a strange way. Like, the people that I've gotten to know are really honing their social skills thanks to nerdcore. They're networking online and then taking it to the next level, which is meeting each other in the real world and stuff. But they're still nerds about it. Even some of the nerdcore shows I've gone to, they will bring TVs into bars and set them up and play PlayStation 3 or whatever, instead of sitting at the bar and having a drink, because they're all drinking soda anyway. They'll go off into their corner and avoid everybody else and play games.
So has making this documentary changed anything about the way you think about nerds, any of your preconceptions?
Yeah, you know, when most people hear the word nerd, they think of a stereotype like from Revenge of the Nerds. And nerds aren't like that anymore. Nerds are, they're still kind of meek and they're still kind of shy and they're kind of awkward and everything, but their numbers are growing quickly. And it's like pod people. We're all slowly being sucked into nerd culture. We can't help it. Everybody is a geek for something these days. everyone has that one kind of little almost embarrassing interest. They have some action figures or something on their desk at work, or they waited in line overnight to go see Iron Man or something. So geek culture is becoming the culture. And I think that's why nerdcore is so, fascinating, is because what two more powerful kind of social movements are there besides hip-hop and geek culture? And now here they are slamming into each other with bizarre results.
Throw up your hands if you like this music. Podcasting DJs, feel free to use it.
Dan Lemereau is the producer and director of the documentary Nerdcore for Life. You can find a link to the Nerdcore for Life website on our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, we'll find out why the nerd stereotype is so not cool. Also, young adult fantasy author Holly Black shares her girl nerd pride with us. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. David Anderegg is a professor of psychology at Bennington College in Vermont. He's also the author of Nerds, Who They Are, and Why We Need More of Them. Dr. Anderegg told Steve Paulson about the inspiration for writing the book.
I first got inspired by a child patient of mine. I'm a child therapist. This was a young man in fourth grade who was seeing me because his grades in school were crashing, and I was trying to figure out what was going on. And in that conversation, he told me that he was intentionally sabotaging himself because he didn't want to be thought a nerd by his classmates. And I thought this was pretty alarming considering the kid was only in fourth grade. And I decided I needed to find out a little bit more about it.
Now, was he getting bullied or teased because other kids thought he was a nerd?
No, absolutely not. He didn't have any of the stigma of nerdity at all. But he was so concerned about it that he was doing this preemptive strike on his scholastic achievement. And so I thought, you know, this is something we need to find out more about.
Hmm. And he used the word nerd.
Absolutely.
Now, I'm assuming that a lot of this would depend on what group of peers a kid hangs out with or what school you go to. I mean, there are some schools that value braininess more, and presumably being a nerd would be less of a stigma.
Well, there aren't too many schools that value braininess more. What's really amazing in doing the research for this book and talking to people about this is how many adults one finds who are totally comfortable expressing their contempt for nerds and geeks in front of their kids, which I find sort of amazing because if you think about, like, one of the things that we supposedly want our kids to do is to do well in school. And nerds and geeks presumably are people who do well in school. It doesn't seem like the sort of thing that, you know, you shouldn't really express contempt for people like that in front of your kids. But it's truly amazing how many adults I know who use these terms in an extremely contemptuous fashion in front of their kids.
Really? That's surprising. I would not have guessed that, especially in this day and age of all the billionaires who've made their money through technology, you know, the Bill Gateses of the world. I'm surprised that there is still such a stigma.
Well, it has to do with the popular culture message that nerds and geeks never hope to get a date. When it comes right down to it, I think there are a lot of parents who, if they had to choose, they would rather their kid be popular in school than be anything even remotely nerdy. At least those are the ones I talk to.
Hmm. Tell me about some of the things that you've actually heard from parents, what they've said.
Well, let me give you an example. This is something that was said to me just a couple of weeks ago, long after the book was written. This is an older lady who was talking about her grandson and bragging about how accomplished he is. She's a very sophisticated person. And she said to me, you know, he's really bright. He's really good in school. But I want you to understand, he's not a nerd. And, you know, just the intonation. When kids hear that intonation, even if they don't know what it is, they think, uh-oh, what's that? I want to make sure I'm not one of those. That's the kind of thing I mean.
Hmm. So you're saying that the stereotype of the nerd is still really damaging. I mean, if kids are labeled that in school, that could really hurt them.
Well, I think it is hurtful to them temporarily. I think most kids who are nerd labeled eventually find each other, and when they get into college, there is this sort of, you know, nerds are cool, this sort of post-high school thing, that it's perfectly okay. I'm actually more concerned about the kids who do the labeling, because I think kids who do the labeling are the kids who limit themselves. These are the kids who don't do well in school, who stay away from science or math and all those things because that's the domain of nerdiness. And they do limit themselves. And somewhere down the road, I think a lot of those kids are sorry that they are not more accomplished in science and math because they were so determined not to get that label when they were younger.
Now, is this a stereotype that is more of a problem for boys than for girls?
Well, as a stereotype, it's a male stereotype. By that, I mean if you ask people to describe a nerd, 99 out of 100 people will describe a boy. So it is something that is usually applied to boys. Later on, there's a concept in high school called girl nerds. But the fact that, you know, girl nerd has that modifier suggests that this is a special weird subtype of nerdiness, which is a male thing.
Hmm. Isn't there also a really insidious association that sometimes goes along with nerdiness, and that's that a boy is considered effeminate? I mean, basically, it's code for homophobia, for labeling a kid as gay.
Yeah, that's true. In the book, I talked to a bunch of kids at younger ages to look at how they acquired the stereotype. There's this very interesting period right around second or third grade when kids use nerd and gay practically synonymously. And what they mean by that is anybody who's too interested in the good opinion of adults is either nerdy or gay. And so I do think that sort of sticks around in the background. And so a lot of the time being called a nerd is a kind of code for being called gay, because although it's not really homosexual, it's just asexual. It's non-sexual.
Hmm. So is the stigma about nerds a particularly American phenomenon?
I believe it is. It's very difficult to study this at present because American culture is all over the globe. And so American stereotypes are all over the globe. And it's very hard to study indigenous stereotypes as opposed to things that are imported. I know I've been having some conversations with people in Brazil, and they're very concerned right now because Brazil is just inhaling American culture. And so what they're seeing is this sort of viral attack of anti-nerd prejudice, which at least the people I talk to tell me has not been a part of Brazilian popular culture up until very recently. So it's really, really hard to study. But the anthropologists I've talked to, as well as the, you know, I've communicated via email with a lot of young people all over the globe, and the anthropologists and the young people tell me that there are a lot of cultures which don't have any indigenous anti-nerd or anti-geek stereotypes.
Well, and in some cultures, we know that academic learning, high achievement in academics, is revered.
Yeah, I was communicating with someone in Turkey who was talking about the fact that they have a national exam, sort of like our SAT, and, you know, the kids who do the best on this exam in Turkey are apparently treated like rock stars. They're interviewed on national TV, and they're celebrities, right? That doesn't happen here, as you may have noticed.
Now, you've said that this can be a pretty damaging stereotype, and parents themselves will perpetuate it. I mean, they will give often not-so-subtle messages to their kids that being a nerd is not cool. What should parents do in terms of how they talk about these things with their kids?
Well, I certainly think parents should not use these terms in front of kids at all. I would like to see us get to the point where using these stereotypes is sort of like an off-color joke. Adults can tell off-color jokes to each other, and they just don't tell them to kids. It's in bad taste to to tell them to kids. And I'd like to see us get to the point where we just wouldn't use these stereotypes at all in front of children. I also think it's really important for parents to not allow their children to digest some of the more extreme cultural products that teach us all about this stereotype. For example, the TV show Beauty and the Geek, I think, should be turned off in every American home because it is absolutely, it instructs everybody that beauty is associated with stupidity and book learning is associated with unsexiness and never the twain shall meet.
David Anderegg is the author of Nerds, Who They Are and Why We Need More of Them. He spoke with Steve Paulson. Should we still be using the label nerd? We'd love to know what you think. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. Holly Black is a best-selling author of contemporary fantasy novels for teens and children. Her work includes Ironside, A Modern Fairy's Tale, and The Spiderwick Chronicles. She's also a contributor to an anthology for teens called Magic in the Mirror Stone. Black told Anne Strangechamps that girl nerds and girl geeks definitely exist.
Absolutely. And I think more now than there was when I was a kid. One of my big claims to geek culture is that I was a huge Dungeons & Dragons player when I was a kid. I actually met my husband through Dungeons & Dragons because we were rival dungeon masters. So I feel that that cements me firmly high in the hierarchy of geekdom. But back then, you know, almost invariably, I would be the only girl in a gaming club or, you know, I would go to gaming conventions and there would be very few women. And we would, you know, look at each other like, yes, we understand. But now, when you go to gaming conventions, there are a lot of women there. And there are a lot of women at comic book conventions. I mean, I think really the culture has become much more open to girls. And I think girls have taken it by storm, too.
So what was it like, you know, sort of back in the day when you were one of the only girls in a room full of guys intensely focused on Dungeons and Dragons? Was that hard?
It was difficult because you're always in that situation when you're the only girl. You know, you learn to adapt and you learn to be able to hang out with guys, and that's kind of a positive thing. But also, I think you feel really weird. You feel really alone. Like, why? Why don't other girls like what I like? You know, why am I always hanging out with a bunch of guys? On the other hand, you know, I joined the chess club to meet boys. So, you know, it's not all bad.
No, but I imagine also that might have been easy at a certain age, you know, 11, 12, and as you moved into 13, 14, 15, it might have seemed more and more uncomfortable, and you might have begun thinking, what's the matter with me, and why am I not like other girls?
I think being the kind of girl who, you know, in high school, I had half a shaved head, the other half dyed blue, and I was reading science fiction and fantasy novels all the time, so it was really only part of the whole, why am I different from everyone else? And I recruited girls to play Dungeons and Dragons when I was a kid. I was in this program for young writers, and I recruited a bunch of the younger girls and taught them how to play. Because, I mean, the thing about geekdom is that it is often kind of viral. You have to give someone a comic book. You have to give them a game. You have to give them a book. You have to sort of bring them in. Introduce them to the world of conventions and all the other strange things that we geeks do.
So it seems as though now we're sort of seeing the reclaiming of the geek. You know, there are now people who talk about being proud to be geeks or proud to be nerds. Do you think that now it's become not just okay, but actually cool to be a geek or a nerd?
I think in some circles it is cool to be a geek. I think in other circles, I think it still has some degree of stigma, but I definitely think it's something that people who are proud of and are pretty pleased with. I think, you know, it has much less stigma than it did, and I think culturally we have a lot more great examples in movies, on television, of the rise of the geek and the power of the geek.
Do you have favorites?
I think Buffy was a huge changeover in terms of how geeks were perceived.
Really? How come?
Buffy meets a bunch of people who are geeks. You know, we have Willow, who's incredibly smart, and Xander, and what she learns from them is that these are highly competent, funny, smart people who are able to save the world with her. And that's a big part of Buffy.
Remember the old ad on the back of comic books, how to get over being a 58-pound weakling?
Mm-hmm.
That used to be the image of the geek or the nerd, you know, this weak little person with no physical force. It sounds like what's happened now is we have this different image of a geek as somebody who can be obsessively into some very obscure thing and read 58-pound books and then also go out and save the world.
Absolutely, with their obscure piece of knowledge that happens to be the key that, you know, once given will fit everything into place. So go us.
So you're actually co-editing an anthology called Geektastic, right?
That's right. With Cecil Castellucci, it's a little brown. And I'm really, really excited about it. We have some really, really, really funny stories and really, really poignant ones too.
And what's the concept of the book?
The concept is stories about geeks or geeks observed. Many different kinds of geekery are invoked in the story. A friend of mine, Cassandra Clare, has a story in there in which she coins a term for the kind of sort of pointless argument that is a staple of geekdom, in which she calls it the dorkument, which is, you know, who would win in a fight, Batman versus Superman? Dorkument. One of my favorite parts. There's a lot of really funny stuff in there.
Can you mention one or two? What are a couple of the sorts of stories that'll be in it?
We have a story about a Rocky Horror Picture Show. We have a story about online role-playing. We have a story about a Klingon and a Jedi who meet at a convention. They like one another, but in a sort of Romeo and Juliet way, their various clans object. They're not actually a Klingon and a Jedi. They're people dressed. They're cosplaying as a Klingon and a Jedi.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have to try and sort through the tangle of, you know, can they be together when they're friends? Would disapprove so strongly.
That sounds great.
Star Trek and Star Wars, you know, their clans do not mesh.
Ali Black is a self-confessed girl nerd. She's also the best-selling author of contemporary fantasy novels for teens and children, and a contributor to a teen anthology called Magic in the Mirror Stone. She spoke with Anne Strangechamps. Roaches with the title track from their 1980 album, Nerds. Well, now we know there is such a thing as girl nerds. But have you ever heard of a war nerd? We'll meet a war nerd next as we conclude our hour on nerds. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Gary Brecher is a data entry clerk in Fresno, California, but he's better known as the War Nerd. Brecher writes the War Nerd column for Moscow's English-language alternative newspaper, The Exile. He's also written a book called The War Nerd. Brecher told Steve Paulson what it means to be a war nerd.
Well, the war part is pretty simple. I've always been interested in war. I always liked it. And the nerd was sort of like a defensive move, if you want to put it in military terms. I wanted to say when I started this column, look, I understand that you can do all kinds of psychoanalysis about why I like war. So let me say up front, yeah, I'm a fat loser and I flunked puberty. And you can link that up with me liking war all you want, but I'm the statistical norm and there are a lot of me out there.
What is it that you like about war?
War is how people settle things. War is when people are serious. War is what matters.
Okay. War is also something that kills a lot of people. And
That's a funny thing. I mean, everybody talks about death. Now, I understand. I used to play Dungeons & Dragons, and there were characters in there who were elves, and elves live about 5,000 years. And when one of them died in the war, I could see, yeah, okay, it's kind of sad. For us, it's like, you remember that movie Blade Runner? It's like we're programmed to die. We get a 6-year lifespan. The only difference is we're not as pretty and not as smart as those robots were. So what's the difference whether it's 6 years or 70 years? I mean, people die in the Horn of Africa. They die living epic lives. And they die in places like Denmark and Fresno, but they die like my grandma did, with tubes coming out of them in a hospital. And that's the worst death I can imagine.
So we're all going to die, so why not go out in a blaze of glory?
Well, it happens. I mean, I think that war is not really going to go out of style, and as long as it doesn't go out of style, you may as well try to talk honestly about it.
Now, I'm curious about the reference you made to growing up as an enthusiast of Dungeons & Dragons, one of the most popular fantasy games ever made. Isn't there a huge difference between that kind of war fantasy and real war that we're seeing around the world these days?
Yeah, of course. This is why I call myself the war nerd. Nerd is, what would you call it? It's like a negative word. I understand there's a negative side to this. I'm trying to skip the tisk, tisk, tisk.
Okay. Well, you say war is fun. Spell that out for me a little bit.
Well, the only kind of war I know about firsthand is studying it. And I've always done that. When I was a kid, the book that meant the most to me was this story of John Paul Jones, this sort of U.S. privateer during the Revolution. And I just remember making a decision when I was about 14 that I liked that story better than what passed for real life, which was, I don't know, a hot sort of suburb in the middle of nowhere.
So you read a lot about war. You immerse yourself in the literature of war.
Yeah, I should refer you to my first column where I said, I'm going to talk about war, but the one thing I'm going to say right now is don't do the psychoanalysis, because I know what I am. I'm a backseat sergeant. I know there's a difference between me and a soldier. And in another column called Tom Clancy is Not One of Us, I said, yeah, okay, I know I'd be a terrible soldier. I mean, I was saying, this was by way of saying Clancy ducked service in Nam, and I said, I wouldn't have done that, at least. I'm not saying I would have been a good soldier. I'd have been a lousy soldier. And I have this bit in that column where I talk about imagining myself stepping on a mine and bleeding out with my entrails lying in a rice paddy and screaming while all the cool guys in the squad laugh at me and play their Hendrix tapes. I know that's how I'd die.
I get the impression that you're not a big fan of Tom Clancy.
I hate Tom Clancy.
Why is that?
Because he's a fat loser coward who made it, and I'm a fat loser coward who didn't make it.
So you're just jealous of him.
Duh. I mean, nobody in America likes the truth very much. Left, right, I don't even understand those distinctions. What I see you all have in common is a real allergy to truth.
The allergy to truth here being that many of us secretly love war and we're not willing to admit it?
No, the shock in your voice when you say I'm jealous. Of course I'm jealous. Jealous is most of the world.
Do you feel at all guilty about liking war so much?
I don't think I understand the question. I've never killed anybody, and I don't think I've contributed to killing anybody any more than any other American taxpayer. The difference is, I just don't live this double life benefiting from the fact that my house is built on some other tribe's land and then pretending to regret that. I mean, I'll always remember when I had to study Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee as a kid. It's like everybody's sobbing for the Indians, but nobody's going to give them the land back. I mean, one way or the other. Either you give them the land back or you admit that you're a predator and you eat meat.
So we might as well admit we're predators.
Yeah.
So what do you think about the current war in Iraq?
I said it was stupid before it started. I said it was going to be the biggest disaster we'd ever had. I'm kind of sort of grimly proud of the fact that I've called it shot for shot, and it's happened exactly the way I thought it would.
So this is, I mean, even though you say that you love war, war is often fun, this is not one of those wars.
No, this one's not much fun, unless you're like a 15-year-old Iraqi who hasn't had his leg blown off by a Marine sniper yet. War is fun for certain people, okay? Like, suppose you're a medieval peasant and there's a war on. The first thing you have to know is, do you have a chance to be a soldier and get some loot out of it? It helps to be male or to be able to pass for male. If you're a woman, war is not going to be that good for you. It goes without saying. War is good for some people. It's not good for old people. It's not good for women. It's not good for children. But if you're a 15-year-old boy on that hormone high, war is great.
And for an older nerd who likes to read about war, I guess it's great too.
It's more interesting than civilian life. We live in a funny point in history, you know. To me, the interesting part of the world ended in 1945. And since then, the Nazis stunk it up for everybody. They stunk up the whole war side of things so bad that there was nothing left except being a yuppie in a suit. And all I know is everybody still dies, and a lot of people still have miserable lives. But somehow you're supposed to pretend that you're not part of that, and that you're off the hook because you don't wear uniforms with death heads in them and go stomping around. I don't see that we've become elves that live 5,000 years or anything. As far as I know, we're still in the bad old Middle Ages, but everybody tries to pretend they're innocent.
Gary Brecher is the author of The War Nerd. He also writes a column of the same name for Moscow's English-language alternative newspaper, The Exile. Brecher spoke with Steve Paulson. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like a copy of this hour, you can call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444 and ask for program number 525B, Revenge of the Nerds. If you have questions or comments about the program, you can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This program was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Mike Ewing, Mary Lou Finnegan, Ann Strange Champs, Charles Monroe Kane, and Veronica Rickard. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen. You can stream To the Best of Our Knowledge on our website at ttbook.org, where you will also find a link to the weekly podcast.
PRI, Public Radio International.